the Soul Jazz Orchestra with People, People. More than a nod, as you can tell, to the great James Brown. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, March the 19th, and we're going inside a major legal battle over the power of a police officer to stop and frisk anyone, even without probable cause to arrest, if the officer has a reasonable suspicion that the person has committed, is committing, or is about to commit a crime, and the officer reasonably suspects the person is armed and dangerous. It is an explosive issue that has ignited protests all across the country, with local governments saying stop and frisks, as they're known, are proven deterrent to crime, and civil rights groups saying it is a legalized form of racial profiling that overwhelmingly targets African-American and Latino males. Later in the program today, we will be talking with a former captain who tells us that many in the law enforcement community themselves take issue with stop and frisks. But first, we go to Roberto Concepcion, who is an associate counsel of Latino Justice, PRLDEF, which means Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund, whose organization has been playing a major part in this case, which is now before, it's in federal court, and it's a civil action. Thank you, Roberto, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. Good afternoon.
Thank you. I understand you were one of the people literally putting this class action suit together. How did it become a class action suit as opposed to a lawsuit representing the immediate people involved?
Sure. As you may already know, in last year, Latino Justice PRLDEF, along with the Bronx Defenders and the NYCLU, filed a lawsuit against the City of New York on behalf of 13 individuals, challenging the NYPD's unconstitutional stop-and-frisk policies implemented pursuant to what has been termed the Trespass Affidavit Program, formerly known in the Bronx as Operation Clean Hall. And pursuant to that program, police officers are permitted to patrol inside and around thousands of private residential buildings across the city. Now, for residents of Clean Hall buildings and their visitors, merely exiting a Clean Hall building frequently leads to persons being stopped, searched, and interrogated by NYPD officers. Furthermore, the residents of Clean Hall buildings are disproportionately Black and Latino, thereby forcing them to bear the demeaning and dehumanizing burden of being stopped and frisked. But Operation Clean Halls is merely an offspring of the NYPD's larger Stop and Frisk program, which is being challenged currently in Floyd versus City of New York, which also disproportionately targets communities of color. So this is not an issue that's just affecting our individual 13 clients, but it's an issue that's affecting, you know, New Yorkers throughout the city of New York. The most recent number, I think there have been more than 4 million New Yorkers stopped as a result of these stop-and-frisk practices. So it's more than just one person that has been subject to these unconstitutional practices. It's, frankly, New Yorkers in general that are subject to these practices, and that's why they, you know, these issues are being brought forth as a class action.
Many people are pointing to a landmark case, a U.S. Supreme Court case, Terry versus Ohio, which is said to have given the police latitude and elastic to do these stops and frisks. The current trial, it seems to me, is not seeking to overturn get rid of the Terry versus Ohio protected activities of the police, but it does seem to be an anomaly, doesn't it? Are you expecting to take this case as far as the Supreme Court to challenge, in fact, Terry versus Ohio?
Well, the current cases that are before Judge Shinlin in the Southern District of New York are not about challenging Terry versus Ohio. Instead, they're challenging the reasons for which police officers on a daily basis are stopping individuals for something other than reasonable suspicion. So as you mentioned, in Terry, the Supreme Court stated that a police can detain a person if he or she has reasonable suspicion that the person has been, is, or is about to be engaged in a criminal activity. So just as an example, we have clients that have been stopped on their way to the supermarket to purchase ketchup. We have clients who were stopped and then eventually arrested just for greeting a neighborhood friend. So unfortunately, the reality is that many of, you know, our clients specifically, but many New Yorkers in general, are just stopped for being Black and or Latino, or are stopped just because they live in what has been deemed as a high crime area. So it's not that the police officers have these reasonable suspicions to perform these stops. If that were the case, then we would not be challenging them. Our clients have told us and shared their stories, and these stories make it very apparent that the police officers didn't have reasonable suspicion to stop our clients. They weren't engaging in criminal activity, and it's for that reason that we've been challenging those practices.
The Center for Constitutional Rights has prepared a rather detailed study of the enormity of this procedure, this practice, and the impact it has had. Annette Dickerson is the Director of Education at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and she joins us now. Thank you, Annette, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Could you give an example? Could you give us some idea of the enormity, the impact of this particular police tactic?
At its highest, at its peak, which I believe was in 2011, 657,000 people were stopped. And many of them have an experience where they are stopped many times. Very often when you ask someone the details of their stop, they will ask you which one. But clearly, we are talking almost three-quarters of a million people stopped in 1 year. And even though the numbers for 2012 are slightly lower, we are still talking about an enormous number of people, the majority of whom are not arrested, the majority of whom are on their way, living their lives, doing their daily business. And even the stated goal of the program to confiscate guns has a yield rate of guns of less than a fraction of 1%.
But what about the city's claim that crime was out of control in the city of New York? And this is typically the argument all across America, especially large urban areas. Crime is a problem. And in fact, the police departments were able to get coverage, legal coverage, to go about doing their stops and frisks under Terry versus Ohio. And these urban areas that have implemented this tactic, especially the city of New York, with the implementation of this tactic, the crime rate has gone down markedly. Therefore, the program is a success. Therefore, it should not be challenged.
There is no credible evidence that links the stop and frisk program with the drop in crime. It's a matter of if you say it enough times, it will be so. There is no credible evidence, and certainly illegally stopping hundreds of thousands. Our lawsuit is a class action, as you know, represents hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of New Yorkers. I think I heard your other guests mention over the years, over 4 million people have been illegally and unconstitutionally stopped. And so the illegal application or the illegal interpretation of Terry is not serving any of the residents of New York City well at all.
So, Roberto, what, therefore, is the aim and objective of the lawsuit? What do you want to come out of it?
I mean, I think there are several aims and objectives to the lawsuit. For example, first, we want the police to be properly trained on what it means to conduct a Terry stop. Our understanding is that police officers don't actually have a good understanding of what it means to have reasonable suspicion to detain someone. We also are of the understanding that police officers are often given performance goals or productivity goals, and so there is this inherent pressure for them to conduct more stops, even when there may not be reasonable suspicion. In addition to that training, we want adequate supervision. We want to make sure that police officers that are on patrol, for example, that they're being sufficiently supervised so that when they are about to conduct a Terry stop or while they're in the process of conducting Terry stops, that there are supervisors that can actually make observations of what they're doing to ensure that they have reasonable suspicion to make these stops. In addition, we also want to be able to review what it is that the police officers are doing. I'm not sure if you're aware or not, but the reason why we even know that there have been, you know, more than 4 million stops is because NYPD collects information regarding each stop that's been conducted. So we want to be able to review those forms on a quarterly basis and make sure that the number of stop and frisks are going down, just because we know that so many of them are unconstitutional. So that's just a few of the things that we're looking for. We're looking for police officers to be better trained, to be better supervised, and we want to engage in an ongoing review of the NYPD's practices to ensure that police officers are only stopping and detaining New Yorkers when they have reasonable suspicion. Otherwise, you know, New Yorkers are just going to be subject to these unconstitutional practices day in and day out without having that relationship of trust that they should have with police officers.
You know, well, Annette, go ahead, okay. Please.
Well, I was going to add to that and say that in Floyd, two of the other remedies that we are seeking is that, you know, members of the community have been dealing with various iterations of police problems with policing for literally decades. And so one of the remedies that we are seeking is an apparatus in which there can be community input into any of the reforms that come out of this lawsuit, because there is clearly a vested interest and much work has been done over the years. And then lastly, we are seeking the appointment of an independent monitor. The police department, which contends that their Internal Affairs Bureau is a sufficient apparatus to police themselves, is clearly not adequate to do that. And so the Floyd lawsuit is also seeking the appointment of an independent monitor.
Could we actually discuss David Floyd, the person after whom this class action lawsuit is named? Could you tell us the specifics of the case against him?
Actually, I'm afraid I'm sorry to say I don't know the specifics of his particular case, that particular day, that particular time. As I said, Mr. Floyd, like the other plaintiffs in the case, have experienced stop and frisk many, many times, and so I must confess that I don't know the specific facts of his particular testimony about this case.
I want to make an observation, and I don't know how it would resonate with you, Roberto and Annette, but it seems to me that we go through these unending cycles of being the people who, though subjected to extremely inhumane treatment, are nonetheless, we're so civil, we're so nice, we're so polite, and it becomes, because of our suffering, look, we got an administrative change. What would you consider to be the rough side, the tough side of this lawsuit? Is it Are you asking for compensatory and punitive damages?
We are not. We are asking for a substantive change in the New York Police Department, because that is something from which all New Yorkers will benefit. You know, very often there are settlements, there are monies that the police department pays out every year, if I'm not mistaken. I heard the number, perhaps it was 2012, that there was $111 million paid out in settlements. This money does not come from the budget of the police department. It comes from the general fund, and so they don't feel it. And so the clients that we have are clients who are class representatives because they want to see a fundamental change in the way that the New York Police Department operates in the city of New York.
But Roberto, why does it always come at the expense? I mean, serious expense. In any other sector of our society, they may have said, well, okay, when you have upwards of 500,000 or 600,000 stops, and it's going, you know, it already says that this is a pervasive problem and one that is not likely to stop, but at the same time, it is costing people in terms of their emotions. They are fearful walking around with the idea that they may at any time be detained. It could even be a case where they could die in the interaction with a police officer doing this stop and frisk procedure. It comes at a cost of loss of time, a cost of feeling of shame. You know, there is a quantifiable cost to the citizen who is thus encountered by this procedure and is inconvenienced. The city seems to understand a monetary value, and I'm a bit stunned that it hasn't come up in the context of the case, and I'll tell you why. When I was reporting on these kinds of things in the city, I remember doing a report all the way back in the early 80s about the city comptroller paying out settlements. And there was also a racial element to it. By and large, the settlements were to white people in the city of New York who, in some way or the other, were harmed by the actions of police officers. The settlements very rarely were to black victims, many of whom were actually even killed in the course of contact with police officers, wrongfully killed. So I'm asking, it's a good thing, like I said, you know, this is the history, it's consistent. African-Americans, Latinos, the suffering transforms into the good for all the people. Is it about time to say, all right, we're going to play a little bit of hardball here? These people are not just their lives are not just simply to be about administrative changes. The city has to understand that this is a grievous act, and therefore it should compensate people so aggrieved.
I mentioned earlier the stop and frisk. There's a very significant cost to it. You know, the program has violated the rights of millions of New Yorkers, it's disrupted our community, and it's damaged the ability of communities of color to trust the police. And our clients, you know, specifically in our Ligon case, I mean, the purpose of them bringing their lawsuit was not to punish the police. It, as Annette mentioned in Floyd, it's about effectuating change. Now, I understand that you think that there are some advantages to making sure that the police have to pay, you know, with compensatory damages, for example. But I don't think that's sufficient. I think that ultimately, for example, the NYPD can have to pay millions of dollars, but ultimately, without effectuating actual and real change to the practices, they will continue. So as Annette mentioned, in Floyd, they're seeking to have this process by which members of the community can actually have a voice about the practices that the police are engaging in and the ones that they should adopt. And in the long run, that is the type of change that will permit New York to be the type of place that residents actually confide in the police that are there to serve them.
Oh, yes, I agree entirely with that. I agree that it should be happening. I'm not saying it should be either or. I think it should be both. Let's get the administrative changes, but let's also get compensatory damages to people who have been grievously harmed for the simple reason that they were walking while Black and Latino. You know, it's really bizarre.
I mean, I too understand where you're coming from, but it's just that in reality, it is too painless and it is too easy for the police department. Again, it doesn't come out of the police department budget; it comes out of the general fund, and so, you know, the millions of dollars that they currently settle have not led to any revelations, any epiphanies, any substantive change in the way that they treat certain residents of the city of New York. And so no matter how much money a plaintiff or class of plaintiffs may get, absent any substantive change where the police department is accountable to the community, is accountable to an independent monitor, where their policies are transparent, where someone has to report and do an audit every year that the public knows about what their policies are and how they're being applied and who is being impacted. Those are the kinds of changes that that I think go above and beyond any financial compensatory figure that could be attached to this.
The City Council's 27-member Black, Latino, and Asian caucus on March the 4th filed an amicus brief in this case. And I was wondering why it was good for them to do that, but considering that they comprise a majority of the City Council and they have the authority to call hearings and to compel accountability from the police department and even from the mayor, why that hasn't been done?
Well, the City Council actually has called hearings, but the New York City, the NYPD suffers from an exceptionalism complex. They are intransigent. They believe that they are in a league of their own. They believe that they are not accountable. And when members, high officials, the commissioner included, of the police department have appeared before the City Council, the disrespect that has been displayed by the police commissioner to the members of the City Council in those encounters is extraordinary.
Yes, but they have subpoena power, and they have the power to compel they have the power to compel respect, actually, and they have the power also to fire a police commissioner who just disrespects the City Council. They have that power. So I was wondering, why didn't the City Council, you may or may not know, but I just note it because in many cases, you know, we find that the leadership would take refuge in this kind of legal action, although they have the weapons right there in their hands to do the job. And sometimes they're a bit too timid to get involved in that. So I thought I would ask the question. Now, the case is expected to last quite a while. Why? Why would the case last so long, Roberto?
Well, I think the case will last a while for several reasons. So just to go back to Ligon very quickly, we only had a preliminary injunction hearing, and that lasted a week and a half. And we only had a fraction of the witnesses that Floyd counsel does. So, you know, imagine they're going to be, at least a dozen either clients or third-party witnesses that will be testifying about their experiences. There's also going to be plenty of police officers that are going to be testifying about the incidents that the clients or the plaintiffs will be discussing. And then you have plenty of the brass that are going to be testifying about, you know, stop and frisk practices throughout New York City. So there's just going to be a vast amount of testimony dealing both with liability and with remedies. And so I think it's only reasonable to expect it to last quite some time.
Thank you for that. Well, you've given us quite a nice orientation about the case, and certainly we will come back and revisit it as it goes. But I want to say thank you, really, for having the courage and for having the tenacity to litigate in behalf of the people, which you've been doing for years, both the Center for Constitutional Rights and Latino Justice. You've been doing a great job. And really, I mean, your work is so essential, and people ought to be very clear that even in the midst of these challenges, all isn't lost. We have people who are very, very close to our community and who are putting their skills and talents, which are quite considerable, to the issue of justice in the city of New York. So thank you both, and good luck with the case as it proceeds.
Thank you for having us.
We'll take a break, and we'll come back and hear from from the inside how this problem looks from the inside right after this. It's Lead, and you're listening to Lead Stories right here on PRN.FM. We're talking about a case that started yesterday in U.S. District Court in Manhattan, which the entire nation, in terms of the city administrations, has eyes trained on this case, as do the law enforcement departments all over the country are going to be closely monitoring this case. We're joined now by one of the nicest people ever on the planet. He paid me to say that. His name is Michael Graves. He is a retired captain in the corrections department in New York City and co-host of a wonderful program called Community Cop. And Community Cop is aimed at getting people to understand their rights, especially when and if they should become involved with police. It is quite a progressive program. It is seen on public access television channels in New York City. Thank you, Michael, for being with us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Did you hear what I said? You are one of the nicest people out there.
And the check is in the mail.
Thank you. No, really, this is a fantastic brother, and so many others are like that. And this is what I say all the time, too. You know, the tendency, Michael, is for people to just have an attitude and you paint with a broad brush. But I can tell you, I have personally experienced it, that I was grateful in many circumstances, especially involving protests and so forth, that we had the presence of African-American and Latino officers with us marching, because I was certain there was going to be very, very serious trouble and there was going to be a lot of hurt. But the last instance was so glaring to me, a protest in Crown Heights where it was unprecedented. The the police force out there. And the members of the Guardians Association, the African American Fraternal Society within the police departments, marched with the protesters in order to secure our safety. I mean, they had everything, sharpshooters, police on horseback, police in plain clothes, uniform police, SWAT teams. It was just unbelievable. But let's talk about, Michael, this stop and frisk. How, you've been in the department for more than 20 years, and you're familiar with it, I'm sure. What do you get back in terms of reaction from your fellow officers?
Well, the thing is, stop and frisk is a valuable tool if used properly. But if you're using it to generate numbers and, in a true sense, to intimidate the black community, now you're doing something unconstitutional. You're taking a good tool that can help get guns off the street, that in some situations can help get drugs off the street, even though the primary focus is weapons. But you've taken that tool and you've used it in a wrong, unconstitutional way based on race, obviously, and now you've taken a valuable tool that can make an officer proud of his day's work, and now you're consciously breaking the law and you're giving illegal orders every day at roll call. You're discharging officers out there knowing full well you're telling them to break the law. They know they're breaking the law, and it just sets up an untenable situation. And unfortunately, we do not have the proper political representation to contest that.
Could you tell us how it could be a valuable tool? How does a police officer use stop and frisk as a valuable tool?
Okay, if you use some measure of probable cause, reasonable suspicion. Quick example, you see a guy walking down the block 2 o'clock in the morning with a grand piano on his back. I think it's safe to ask him, excuse me, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. Is that yours? Can you verify that somehow? That's safe. But if a guy is walking down the block just because he has a sweat hood on and baggy pants, does not put you in a position to stop him because he's going into public housing, to stop him and ask him, where is he going? What's he doing? Now you got the hands up. Now you're searching him. That's illegal. That's totally illegal. That's not what it's supposed to be on the surface. That's not what it's for. You've taken a valuable tool and made it unconstitutional.
Now, you said a very interesting phrase there, and that is reasonable suspicion. Now, when we use phrases like that, invariably, we come to cultural dissonance, because cultural compatibility. If you come from a community that you are now policing or you're very familiar with, you are likely not to be, quote, threatened, or you are likely not to see certain behaviors as being suspicious. You are likely to say, it's cool, but this particular phrase, reasonable suspicion, has accounted not only for brutal encounters between police officers and civilians, but even deaths. So with this concept of stop and frisk, should there be some kind of a cultural training so that people understand what it is they're looking at? It's not because a guy is wearing a hoodie, as was in the Trayvon Martin case, it doesn't mean that he's out to murder half the village.
Well, I do not think you need any special cultural training for stop and frisk. You need cultural training just to work in New York City, period. Now, it's not like the NYPD is not trained. It is among the best trained, and I dare say the best trained police department in the country, especially if we look at the dollars that's being spent to make sure you're well trained. I would say that the reason why I know it's not a training issue is because these same things are not replicated in the white community. So it's not a question of training. Unfortunately, we have representation, whether it's of a legal nature, where, you know, I mean, you know, America, for the most part, is a litigious society in that it tries things in court a lot. But unfortunately, when our issues go before the courts, it's always settled. We do not have the proper political representation that's going to raise the proper questions as to why are people being stopped in the black community, young men primarily, and they're not being stopped in the white community. They're not being stopped in, if you want to break it down, the religions, whether it's Catholic, Jewish, and others. They're not being stopped. But the main thing is race, because that's what you can see. And only blacks and Latinos, for the most part, are going through this. So it's not a question of training. There's intent there. There's purpose. There's a pattern in practice. When, put it as, look, when Giuliani, his last year, 100 blacks in law enforcement, of which I'm a co-founder of, raised the question with Giuliani when he had 95,000 documented stops. 95,000. Now, at that time, maybe 3% resulted in arrests. 3 to 6% the most resulted in arrests. We felt those numbers were obscene. However, you have Mayor Michael Bloomberg that jumped to 400,000, 500,000, and never has been in the last 6, 7 years under 500,000. Now, the Attorney General's office, New York State Attorney General's office, says casually that only 1 out of 10 stops is documented. Now, 100 blacks in law enforcement, we say only 1 out of 20. But let's go with the Attorney General's estimation. If 1 out of 10 stops are documented, that means Giuliani actually did 950,000, and that means Bloomberg last year did 7 million. Just by the Attorney General's numbers, if 1 out of 10 is only documented, and he did 700,000. So, I mean, can you imagine? This is nothing but a state of tyranny. When you really look at it as on the on what it really is that when you can get Police Commissioner Kelly tell black elected officials in a closed-door meeting that his intent is to search every black young person and Latino person, well, he said black for the most, so I'll just use his words. He said every black youth has to know that anytime they walk out their door, there's a possibility they'll be searched. So he's saying that, you know, if you want to come out here carrying a gun, we're going to take it from you, and we're going to lock you up. So he's basically saying that to black elected officials. The black elected officials didn't tell us. They didn't tell us when this happened. They didn't say, well, is that constitutional? Or and since some of them are lawyers, they should have told them that's not constitutional. But he was able to say that. But that's in a long line. This is progressive behavior from a police commissioner out of control because he's disrespected the city council so many times in the past that it's actually their fault that they've allowed it to the point where he can tell you, yeah, you, I'm going to treat them any way I want to. Similar to, you know, how that district attorney in Gina said, I can, with the pen, change your whole life. And, you know, you have a police commissioner saying the same thing.
That why, Michael,
you,
why has this not
the law.
Why has this not become something for the Justice Department to look at?
Well, I think the Justice Department is fully aware of the pattern in practice. It's been said so many times in so many forums, and the head of the Justice Department, Eric Holder, is from New York, specifically Queens. He's fully aware of what happened to Sean Bell. And he hasn't said a peep about it. And those who were supposed to be fighting the leading the Sean Bell cause claim that this was going to end up looked at by the federal courts. It never happened. You know, and I don't think they ever pushed it. They pretend to have such a cozy and close relationship with the president, and they've had the Attorney General Holder at at certain functions here in New York. So he's fully aware of what happened to Sean Bell. He's fully aware of the pattern in practice. Bloomberg had to go to the Justice Department to get a third term because New York is under the Voters' Rights Act. So there's obviously some alliances here in the city with the federal government, President Obama's office, the Justice Department, and obviously they know when to look the other way because, believe me, if the Jewish community said the same thing, and we are 100 times larger than the Jewish community, but if that small community in Crown Heights or Williamsburg or Sunset Park said the very same things were happening to them, this would be cleared up in New York right away because the governor would do something. It wouldn't even get to the federal government. The governor or the attorney general would do something about that. So I think that all the elected officials, they're not sleeping at the wheel. They're fully awake. They see what's going on, and they're allowing it to happen because the governor can remove the mayor and he can remove the police commissioner if he chose to do so.
You mentioned earlier, as you when you started talking about the issue here today, that the orders are coming from on high to boost the numbers and therefore the zeal of police officers to engage in this stop and frisk pattern. But still, do you hear or do you know of officers within the ranks who refuse to do the stop and frisk?
Oh, it's no doubt about it. It happens every day. I mean, Noel Leader was just saying on the program the other day that when he was, as a sergeant, was told to do X number of stop and question in prison, he always told those under him that if you don't see anything, you're not making any illegal stops. So, I mean, that's been basically a theme consistent with 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement. We're not going to break the law because technically any illegal order, you're not mandated to follow. That was established way back in the Nuremberg trials. So no one can say, well, I'm only doing it because I'm ordered. No one should be able to order you to break the law. If nobody's not doing anything and you're being told you have to do X number of arrests a week, you can't just arrest people just to bulk up your numbers and then expect everything to be fine and dandy, because if there's any type of remedy, you're going to have to testify in court now as to your behavior. And the PBA will not always be able to say, if we get the right people in place, then the PBA, you know, will not be able to save you.
The PBA is the police union.
Right.
You're watching this case, I'm sure, and I'm sure that your organization, 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement, Who Care, and, of course, for your own program, you and your fellow officers and ex-officers are watching this. What are you looking for in this trial? What are you paying attention to?
Well, we want to see just the latitude that the judge will allow in this case. We want to see just how far the lawyers are willing to go, because unfortunately too many times they settle, and the clients, they come with some economic recompense, and unfortunately it stops right there. And the police department always emerges or reemerges from the fray unscathed because there's some type of settlement. Consequently, a part of that settlement will be that, you know, the police officers or the police department itself bears no responsibility, but, you know, the city is paying you, but, you know, you have to keep your mouth shut. And too many times, whether it's the Sean Bell case and so many other cases, that's what happens. We have these lawyers that settle. We don't have the pit bull lawyers like Attorney Alton Maddox and others who wouldn't settle, who would really, the goal would be for justice as opposed to getting a street sign named after you and getting a few dollars and telling you to go on your way.
Well, what do you think? I made the observation along those lines, saying that, you know, it's a good thing that there are people taking on these cases, but considering that this has been going on for decades now, at least one decade and more, that, you know, we need to see some kind of hardball, both at City Hall, meaning the City Council. The City Council basically just said, well, okay, we are going to file a friend of the court brief in support of it. But actually, they have the legislative authority to compel the police department to behave differently. So what do you think about that?
Well, if they have teeth, they haven't shown them. Now, yes, they do have subpoena power, and they can demand that Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly appear before them, but they have not really showed that type of character. I would just say that I was observing City Councilman Jermoni Williams just actually begging the mayor and the police commissioner just come out to a black community. And he's not calling for justice, because when we were out there together Friday, my call was for justice. His call was to have Ray Kelly come out here and speak to the people. Every time Ray Kelly gets in front of black folks, for one thing, he's very dismissive. If you're not on his side, he's very dismissive and he's very disrespectful.
Well, you have to leave it there, though, because we're running out of time. Michael, thank you so much, Michael Grace, for being with us. And again, look for Community Cop in New York City on your public access television channel. I want to urge you also to continue the conversation. We'll get to your questions and calls later on in the week, but we had a full plate and I thought it was important for us to hear what is at issue. Reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com or on Facebook with facebook.com/leadstories. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see each other tomorrow. You don't want to miss tomorrow. You don't. Call all your friends and let them know you don't want to miss tomorrow.